Welcome to the first lecture of the 19 letters, and this first letter is entitled Complaint. And in this letter, Benjamin, who is the young man who's about to get married, he's writing to Naftali, who's the rabbi, and he's writing all of his complaints about Judaism. Now, if I was doing this in like a classroom setting or some other public type setting, so I might have those participating list specific problems that they have with Judaism for comparison's sake. First of all, do we have the same complaints as Benjamin is going to articulate, or have things changed? Can we relate to what Benjamin's saying, or do we feel that things have really changed? And also to see if Rav Hirsch's answers, his solution, fits the same problems that we have. So in Rabbi Elias's introduction, he breaks this down into basically three parts. So the first is the complaint that Judaism doesn't do what a religion is supposed to, and according to Benjamin's arguments, it should bring happiness and perfection. And Torah observance really limits a person's pursuit of art and science, and people really get involved with what he calls trivialities. His second point that he says is that Judaism is kind of impractical for today. And third, he says that he feels that reform is kind of a sham. And if he's going to drop anything, he would drop Judaism entirely. And he would not even deal with changing to reform, which he feels is already a step away from Judaism. So I think the best way to do this is probably I'm going to read each paragraph, and any comments that I have, I'll say at the end of each paragraph. So he starts off as follows. He says, "My dear Naftali, after a separation of many years, you chanced to travel through the town where I live, and we had the good fortune to meet again for a short fleeting hour. You cannot imagine, my dear Naftali, what interest the subject of our conversation had for me, and what interest it still has. You found me so changed in my religious views, and even more so in my actions and practices, that in spite of your genial, tolerant nature, you could not hold back the questions that sprang spontaneously, as it were, to your lips. Since when? Why? In response, I gave voice to a whole series of accusations against Judaism, about which my eyes have been opened by reading and coming into contact with the world only after I had left my parents' home in Herth." Now, I think this point is significant, that Rav Hirsch points out that he only knows Judaism from his parents' home. In his parents' house, he's isolated. He's not in what we would call the real world. And in this situation, anything that he's doing which is Jewish is merely done out of habit. And a few lines down, Rav Hirsch calls it the mechanical practice of parental customs, as we'll see shortly. In other words, he never has to really question anything or confront anything from the outside until he is actually in the world itself. So continuing, "You listened quietly to my tirade, and when I had done, you only replied, 'Do you believe that you really understand the concepts which you are attacking? Have you gained by means of honest, earnest investigation an actual understanding in your own mind of something which should at least not be thrust aside thoughtlessly without reflection, since it is the holiest and most important matter in our life?'" So as with everything, when a person's arguing or attempting to understand an issue, you really have to have a lot of knowledge about the topic under discussion. And Naftali here is placing doubt in Benjamin's mind by pointing out that Judaism shouldn't just be cast aside if one considers it the holiest and most important part of existence. And again, the premise of the book is that it's really only for someone who has a true desire to investigate and to find out. It's not really for someone who is apathetic or is already convinced. "You showed me the only sources of my knowledge were, on the one hand, the mechanical practice of parental customs and a few poor fragments of Bible and Talmud acquired from Polish Jewish teachers, little understood and little digested, and on the other hand, Christian writers, modern Jewish reformers of our faith, and above all, that view of life which our present age has produced, whose chief purpose and goal is only the suppression of the inner voice of conscience in favor of the external demands of comfort and ease." So a couple of comments here. When Rav Hirsch mentions Polish Jewish teachers, so he's really dissing the teachers of the time, which were really ineffectual. They didn't have the ability to properly transfer information over to the students. So partly this is because they lacked any sort of education, specifically in pedagogy, and they were really unprepared to deal with enlightenment, to deal with the modern world. And Hirsch contrasts this to Christian writers, as he says, and modern Jewish reformers who are educated, and they do have some awareness of the world and life. And the last point that he mentioned, that that the chief purpose and goal is only the suppression of the inner voice of conscience in favor of external demands of comfort and ease. So this part of comfort and ease, to me, very much sounds like today, or at least a lead-up up to today, that instant gratification and luxuries could easily be looked upon as being the ichor. I was forced to confess how insufficient my knowledge was, and I begged you for instruction, for guidance and education. But then the coachman called, and in bidding me goodbye, you had time only to call out in writing. So, my dear Naftali, you have made me uncertain and distrustful of the views which I have held till now. But you have not refuted them, nor have you given me better ones to take their place. I am putting something in writing. It gives it a special significance, and it forces the one writing to solidify what they're putting on paper. And people also have a certain respect for things that are in writing as opposed to something which is just said orally. Now, Rav Hirsch is going to discuss what the prevalent ideas of what a religion, what the real purpose of religion is supposed to be. And I'm sure if you ask a lot of people, you'd probably get different ideas of what they have, of what they think a religion should be. So he says, I am therefore taking advantage of your kind permission and will repeat to you in writing several of my arguments, not for the purpose of defending my present mode of life, but in the sincere desire for better information and guidance. Every religion, I believe, should bring man nearer to his true purpose. This purpose, what else could it be but the attainment of happiness and perfection? So, just to break in, I know it's the middle of the paragraph, but you have to question if this sounds like a valid argument or not. Now, from a point of modernity, where man is the center of the universe, and there really is no higher authority, it is a valid argument, because it's kind of egocentric. He's looking at himself as being the main purpose for what the religion is. And based on the current societal mode of thinking, we might or might not feel the same way. Meaning, if you would ask somebody before the time of enlightenment if the true purpose is to bring personal happiness, a person might think you're crazy. But once you're in a lifestyle where man is the center, then certainly this makes a lot of sense. So continuing, yet if we measure Judaism by these criteria, what utterly depressing results we do obtain. To what sort of happiness does Judaism lead its loyal followers? From time immemorial, misery and slavery have been their lot. They have been misunderstood or despised by the other nations, and while the rest of mankind has ascended to the summit of culture, attaining prosperity and fortune, the adherents of Judaism have always remained poor in everything which makes human beings great and noble, and which beautifies and dignifies existence. So presumably this refers to like art, the arts, education, culture, etc. The Torah law itself forbids every enjoyment. It is a hindrance to all the pleasures of life. Moreover, for 2,000 years we have been tossed around by others like a plaything, a bouncing ball, and we are, even at this time, banished from all paths of happiness. So again, this could probably be debated if we feel that way as well. As for perfecting our human qualities, what culture, what conquests in the domain of science, art, or invention, in a word, what great achievements have Jews wrought in comparison with the Egyptians, Phoenicians, Greeks, Romans, Italians, French, English, or Germans? Now, over here, when he discusses these great achievements and that Jewish people don't have, so Benjamin is not referring to individual Jews, because surely there have been many Jews that have contributed over time. I mean, you could think more in terms of our time, which obviously is after this was written, but like Einstein and Salk, I mean, you can come up with probably hundreds of names who have contributed. Rather, he means the Jewish people, and specifically, he obviously is referring to the regular Orthodox Judaism. And if we look at the other nations over here, so for example, let's take some of the things that each one of these nations have done. So the Egyptians, they were one of the first ones with math, certain types of quarrying and making buildings, pyramids, monuments, temples, obelisks, certain types of glass technology. They had some kind of system of medicine, literature, irrigation systems, agricultural production techniques, certain types of art and architecture. In Rome, we know that certainly when it came to structure, they created the arch, which completely reconfigured different types of architecture. We know they had sewer systems and pools, and we know the Roman language, certainly. They had a democracy, etc., etc. So these nations, we know, have all contributed vastly to the world that we live in. Okay, if anyone's curious as to some of these other countries, let's say like the Italians or the French or the English, Germans, etc., if you just look it up on Google, you'll find lists of things that they have contributed. Continuing, utterly deprived of all characteristics of nationhood, we are nevertheless considered a nation, and every one of us is doomed by his very birth to form an additional link in this chain of misery. And when he says that we're utterly deprived of nationhood, we mostly, throughout our history, have not had our own homeland, we have not had our own language, yet nevertheless we're considered a nation. And he continues, the Torah is chiefly at fault for this. By its laws that ensure our isolation in life, it arouses, at the very least, suspicion and hostile distrust. So we know that keeping the mitzvos, which by default it isolates us somewhat, causes nations to distrust us, or at least this is the argument that he's making. By bending our spirit to the point of humble submissiveness, it invites contempt. It blocks the pursuit of the creative arts. Through its dogmas, it bars the way to free thought and speculation. In terms of pursuit of creative arts, so we know that the Torah does not allow us to participate in things that are overly sensual. And his argument that through the Torah's laws, we don't have free thought and speculation. So I think this means that if you look at the typical Jew of the time, so he's always consumed every minute with Torah, so he can't have any free thought or speculation. He's always involved in these just ancient texts, nothing to do with us, and you're just totally, your life is totally subsumed by that. By imposing a life of isolation, it indeed removes every incentive for exertion in science and art. Therefore, they do not flourish among us. As for the study of our religion, it merely distorts the mind and leads it astray into subtleties and the minutiae of petty distinctions until it becomes incapable of entertaining simple, straightforward opinions. Thus, I have always wondered more than a little how you, who know how to appreciate the beauties of Virgil, Tasso, and Shakespeare, and can fathom the logical edifices of Leibniz or Kant, can find pleasure in the formless, tasteless writings of the Old Testament or the illogical disputations of the Talmud. So in the beginning of this paragraph, when he refers to the study of religion, so I believe that this is a reference to Gemara, which he's not happy with. And then he goes on his tirade here of how you, meaning Naftali, you who appreciates all these modern writers, still find pleasure in the Torah and in the Gemara. So when one compares the more modern writers with the Torah as far as pure literature is concerned, Benjamin here, he's disappointed. Now, I have a little bit of trouble with this because it doesn't seem like such a fair complaint to me. I think that the Old Testament is the best known book on earth, and it's constantly studied, and even for purely literary pursuits. And further, I would hazard to say that most people don't have such an appreciation for all these people that are listed here. So let's go through some of them. Virgil, or I hope I'm saying his name right, he was a classical Roman poet, and he was considered one of Rome's greatest poets. Tasso, he was an Italian poet in the 16th century, and until up to the 19th century, he was considered one of the most, he remained one of the most widely read poets in Europe. Shakespeare, so we know he lived from the in the 15th and 1600s, he was an English poet, playwright. He was considered the greatest writer of in the English language, and the world's preeminent dramatist. And I could honestly say I have very little appreciation for Shakespeare. Leibniz, he was a German philosopher. He was a mathematician. He wrote in Latin and French. So you see, all these, apparently, these were very much studied by the enlightened people of the time that Refersch is writing this. I mean, today we could say the same argument, just slightly differently. We would say that how could it be that a rabbi who is involved in the things that we're involved with today could still be involved with Torah and with Gemara. So you just have to change the complaint, and I think it will fit right in. And what is their effect upon one's heart and life? The heart becomes exclusively absorbed in anxious scruples about insignificant trifles. Nothing is taught except to fear God. Everything down to the smallest, pettiest detail of life is referred directly to God. And this will be explained in the following paragraph. Life itself becomes a continuous monastic service. So monastic means secluded, like monks. So again, life itself becomes a continuous monastic service, nothing but prayers and ceremonies. This idea of ceremonies is important, and we're going to address this later on. The most praiseworthy Jew is the one who lives the most secluded life and who is the least of the world, though he permits it to support him. He wastes his life in fasting, praying, and poring over meaningless writings. Now, I would say that he's got quite a complaint here. I mean, I could relate to this, especially when one looks into certain parts of the yeshiva world from an outsider's perspective, and we're definitely not going down the yeshiva route here. You could definitely see how someone would come away with this conclusion. Look for yourself at the book which is presented to us as the path of life, which contains all the duties of the Jew. Now, this is a reference to Orach Chaim, which is the first chelik in Shulchan Aruch, and that mostly deals with the details of everyday life. And as we pointed out in the introduction, Rav Hirsch was upset that the Shulchan Aruch was divided into four volumes, and that led to the belief that Judaism is not concerned with the rest of life as it is in the Shulchan Aruch. So continuing, what else does it teach but praying, fasting, and observing the festivals? Where is there a single word concerning our duties toward the active, busy life around us? What happened to life itself? And this, especially in our time, why it is quite impossible to keep these laws intended for an entirely different age. What limitations in traveling, what embarrassment in our association with the Gentiles, what difficulties in every business activity. So think like travel, Shabbos, Yom Tov, in terms of embarrassment. We have kosher in business activities, money, yichud. So it gets very complicated, and he's saying he's embarrassed by such a thing. So he says, please do not point in reply to the current efforts to reform Judaism. There, indeed, everything that does not harmonize with today's concepts of the destiny of man or the needs of the time is being pared away little by little. But is this not in itself a step outside Judaism? Would it not be better then to adopt and implement these current concepts consistently on their own, instead of tying them to ideas that are at variance with them, which can only produce an arbitrary patchwork? So the priori here is that anything outside of Judaism is a farce and it's not really worth looking at. Either give me the real thing or nothing. And Judaism, you can't really make it more satisfactory. It's something which is supposed to be objective and not subjective. And this will keep the conversation that we're going to have here focused around authentic Judaism. Moreover, for such reforming efforts, we also lack unity. legally constituted legislative body's authority. All such efforts remain only the strivings of individuals. The most divergent opinions prevail among the rabbis and preachers. While some, as enlightened men of the time, tear down, others hold fast to the shaky structure and would rather be buried under it. So his complaint here is that the Jewish structure is a mess, and the rabbis are fractured, they're arguing, and we lack unity, we have no central authority. I myself recently saw a young rabbi who, whenever he travels, contents himself with prisoner's fare in simple-minded piety, and when one visits him, he can still be found poring over the folios of the Talmud. He is even said to grieve earnestly over the fact that some of the members of his congregation are so far advanced in enlightenment that they do not close their places of business on the Shabbos. What shall become of us, dear Naftali? I'm about to marry, but God knows, when I think that perhaps I shall have to exercise the duties of a father to children, I tremble. So you see from here that he's very concerned for his people as a whole, and he's very serious that these issues directly affect him, and they leave him confused. Excuse me, dear friend, for having spoken so freely about something which I know you revere, and I suppose you must as a rabbi, on account of your position. So this here, this is a big diss, because he doesn't believe that rabbis could be impartial and that they're really truly believing what they say. And this was a huge mistrust that existed then, and perhaps today also to an extent, that the rabbi, he must preach this way because that's his position and that's his livelihood. And just like any professional would have to speak about their position, and this shouldn't be that a Jew with his convictions should be the same way. And Rav Hirsch mentions this problem to put it in the open, and he's going to address it just about immediately in his response. Still, I am confident that you have sufficient affection left for me from our former days so that in answering me you will forget your office. For what that teaches, I know quite well. With my good wishes, Benjamin. So he says that he knows quite well what the office of the rabbinate teaches, which is, again, this misery, being stuck in this chain and keeping all the old, etc., everything that we've spoken out. So I guess the questions at the end of this is, in terms of us, how much of what Benjamin is saying could we relate to today? And if we have the same problems, are our problems worse? And can we relate to these issues and extend them to today? And I believe that with just about all of them, they either fit or they could be modified to fit pretty easily into our society and to issues that we have.